31 Surprising Reasons to Believe in God. This is a book, as we go through this, that gives you 31 surprising reasons to believe in God, but the subtitle, which you may not be able to read very well, How Superheroes, Art, Environmentalism, and Science Port Towards Faith. And you go, what? This is a great book to hand to one of your skeptical friends. You know, sometimes when you do an evangelism, you say, well, is there a book that maybe would answer their question? And certainly if you have somebody who's dealing with the issue of evolution, you know, a book on creation or a book on intelligent design would be helpful. Even the book we talked about a few weeks ago, The Case for Christ, is written in such an engaging way by Lee Strobel, who is an individual that has very significant academic credentials, but he tells you about interviews he does with William Lane Craig and others. And for people that are kind of intellectual, that would be the case. This is a book that I would say you might want to hand to somebody who is just sort of into the popular culture, loves art or music or something like that. And so it is just, I think, a really fascinating book. And we're going to go through just some of the 31 reasons. Although I have enough slides today, I'm beginning to wonder if this could be 2 weeks. We'll see how this goes today, especially given when we started. But he starts with an interesting story that illustrates the book. And that is, a number of years ago, in Northern California, a family noticed the top of an old rusted can that was protruding from the ground. And they wondered if somebody had buried some garbage and everything. So they tried to unearth the can, and it turned out that the can was much heavier than it was expected. Because when they opened it up, it was full of gold coins. Well, then they started digging around a little bit more and ended up finding actually 8 cans, 1,400 gold coins, which just went up an auction about a year ago, $11 million. Wouldn't you like to find anything like that in your little walk through California? Matter of fact, Rick Stebbins says, you know, I know where they found it, so every once in a while when I go up there, I just look around just in case he may have buried him somewhere else too. Okay, well, he uses this as a great story, and that is the couple, who's still pretty much anonymous. You can read about them on YouTube and things like that, but they've never actually said their names, were asked if they had any clue before the find. Did they remember noticing any things in the years before? And what they said is they did remember seeing this tin can that was kind of tied to the tree and had been there for so long, the tree had sort of grown a little bit around the can. Well, it was an obvious marker to where the treasure was. Now, the mother, I saw in one of the interviews, said, well, she thought the can might have been there for flowers. Maybe somebody had been buried there or something like that. But nevertheless, the point he's making, and Rick makes, I think, a very powerful point, and he was a professor, now is a pastor in a church in Northern California, is the clue to the treasure was there, but they were unaware that it was a clue. And what he's arguing here is that God has left us some clues, but sometimes they're more difficult to follow. Today, Pastor Graham took us through Deuteronomy 6, verse 4 and following, but it occurred to me there's another passage in Deuteronomy very famous, and that's Deuteronomy 29:29. The secret things belong to the Lord our God, but the things that are revealed belong to us and to our children forever, that we may do all the words of this law. And so, kind of what he's saying is that there are some other arguments, if you will, for the existence of God that we see every day, and they're just like the clues of those gold coins, but we really haven't paid attention to them. So if you have a handout, I'm going to take you through the 5 sections in his book. We're not going to look at all 31, but I'm going to look at some that I thought were kind of interesting. And if you find yourself wanting to get some more information, of course, this book is out. It just came out a couple of weeks ago, published by Harvest House. You can probably find it in your local bookstore. The presentation I'm giving right now, for those of you that are visitors, you can go to prestonwoodexamined.org and actually follow along. Or if you have a smartphone or a tablet, you can see some of this. So again, if you'd like to use some of this later, as you talk with one of your non-Christian friends, this is kind of our evangelistic moment. This is, I think, a really good tool to put in your hands. Well, the first one he talks about is what he calls the ecstasy and agony of beauty. And he starts off with superheroes. Isn't that interesting? You gotta love a guy that was getting a PhD in philosophy, who's a pastor in Northern California, that opens his book by talking about superheroes. Now, how in the world does that relate? He starts each chapter by saying, da-da-da-da-da, therefore God exists. And his argument here is superheroes and fantasy movies aren't just for kids, therefore God exists. And he asks a good question. Who would have predicted 50 years ago that grown-ups would go into a theater to watch a movie about a Jedi Knight, or go into a theater to watch about a teenage boy with spider abilities? You would think that in a society that is becoming more secular, would we all agree that's the case, that if anything, interest in the supernatural would have diminished. And his argument, and the argument comes from a very scholarly book, which I'm going to quote just now in just a minute, is that it's just the opposite. Belief in the supernatural is supposedly on the decline, but yet we flock to these heroes and villains that have some kind of superhuman or magical powers. Very good book came out in 2001 by Michael Jones called The Monsters from the Id. And his argument is that society has become more and more materialistic. And what that's done is it's kind of pushed the idea of the supernatural further from our conscious mind. So then it surfaces in our subconscious mind, kind of a desire to see something supernatural. If you think about this, if you live in a world where you don't believe there's any God, there isn't any supernatural, there isn't any heaven, there isn't any hell, there isn't any life after death, after a while you maybe would actually want to seek out something kind of supernatural. So the argument he makes is that in some respects the popularity of some of these superhero movies in some respects illustrates only so well that in some respects we still have a desire for the supernatural. Let's take a different example. I don't know if you realize, but this is the anniversary, the 80th anniversary of the publication of this series by J.R.R. Tolkien. That was written 80 years ago. Now, if you told him 80 years ago this would be a popular movie, nobody believed, but let's just bring it up to recent time. If I told you 2 decades ago that this book series, which a lot of Christian nerds read, but nobody really else read, but if I told you 2 decades ago that they were going to turn this into movies, first of all, you'd have some doubts. If I told you that these movies were going to be international blockbusters, you really would have some doubts. And if I told you that those movies actually would be nominated for Academy Awards, you would think I had lost my mind, wouldn't you? And yet here, again, see, this one is not just superheroes. This one has a lot of Christian themes, doesn't it? Good and evil, temptation, the afterlife, all sorts of things are tied up into it. And I think it illustrates again, kind of one of those, if you will, hidden reasons why we might believe in God. You know, after all, Ecclesiastes says God has placed eternity in the heart of individuals. And so as a result, we sort of desire for the supernatural. We're going to get into that a little bit more in just a minute. But the first argument that he makes, and this is a whole chapter, so I'm summarizing these chapters. If Pastor Rick Stedman were here right now, he's going to say, is that all I get for that whole chapter? Yes, that's all you get, because we're moving on to the second one. And that is, what about all these horror movies? Now, this one's kind of the flip side of it, but again, his argument is, horror movies and books are shockingly popular, therefore God exists. And again, he says, since our society is so increasingly secular, how is it that a novelist like Stephen King has become one of the best-selling authors of all times? And again, let's go back to E. Michael Jones in his book, The Horror of the Id. He argues that society has sort of repressed this idea of the supernatural, and so those feelings and those desires and those needs surface in all sorts of other arenas. And so basically what we have is the flip side. For superheroes, what you have is kind of the process of sublimation, where I kind of try to no longer think about that, and trying to deny our the idea of the supernatural, still our emotions and our beliefs kind of bring that up in a positive way. So we kind of long for someone who could be a salvation, someone that could actually be a savior, someone that really could be supernatural. The horror films are just the opposite. That's not sublimation, it's displacement. It's really attaching a repression to the negative ideas. And so horror produces, he says, another kind of hint of God in kind of a huge twist. That is the destructive consequences that result when we try to deny belief in God's existence. I won't go into it in a lot of detail, but he spends a fair amount of time talking about the first, if you will, science fiction book, which is Frankenstein. Now, if you know anything of the story of Mary Shelley, she had really bought into this idea of humanism, that human beings could save themselves, and human and humanity and humanism would be the great salvation in the future. But when she went through a divorce, went through all sorts of difficulties in her life, she began to turn her heart away from that idea. And the premise there is Dr. Frankenstein thinks that he can create something that will be positive, and it turns out to be an incredible horror. And so again, horror movies kind of play to this idea, this dystopia, even this idea of the fact that we have sin, we have a fallenness, we have evil, we have decadence. And so again, another aspect of that with some of these movies. But one of the reasons these movies are so filled with monsters is they're kind of illustrating the rebellion against the moral order, the rebellion against even the idea of God. And so Michael Jones explains that the calamities described in horror fiction are really repressed moral truths. Horror is morality written backwards. And of course, one example is as we remove God, we birth our own what? Frankensteins. So anyway, that's the second point. Let's take music. This one I think is very helpful as well. And that is that he says, music moves my soul like nothing else. Therefore, God exists. Now, if you want a quote from a very famous humanist, who, of course, has given us a very famous play as well, Victor Hugo, he said, music expressed that which cannot be put into words and cannot remain silent. And if you think about music, Pastor Graham even mentioned music in terms of teaching our kids hymns and things like that, but whether it's the music of a symphony or whether it's pop music or whether it's music we sing in the church, there is something that is really special about music that really moves our soul. And if anything, it has become such an important part of our cultural phenomenon, and it's one of those transcultural situations. I was just reading the other day about how, again, in Japan, you will hear Bach and Beethoven. I mean, this is Japanese, you know, but they're playing and singing some of the things that are part of Western culture, even though they're in the East. Now, if you think about this, interestingly enough, this is something that really raises some questions if you start from an evolutionary point of view, if you start from an atheistic point of view. Rachmaninoff, I love his poem here. No prophet, no warrior bold, no leaned mantle wearing, but as I go, my harp I hold, the grace of God declaring. And so there seems to be something about this. And really, from a theistic perspective, the structure inherent in music is reflective of the structured kind of law-abiding universe. And so, in some respects, the fact that music works is because it shows God's order. You can think of John Cage, if you're familiar with him, you know, where you have just random sounds and it never really caught on. I mean, you have to have something that makes music work. Meter, rhythm, timbre, volume, harmonics. You have tension, you have resolution, you have some really disturbing parts of a symphony, and then it's resolved at the end. This relates to the human experience. And so, again, music touches the soul. But if all we are just evolved animals, why does music do that to us? Why does there almost seem to be a transcendent quality to that? And this is why, again, Rick Stedman refers to that as another example. Music is kind of a subset of the broader one now, because he talks about this idea of beauty and art. And again, his argument is, I love beauty and art, therefore God exists. Now, this is, again, one of those things that brings us all together. I don't know if you're a Christian or a Buddhist or a Hindu. I don't care if you're a believer or a non-believer. We can all go to the Morton Meyerson Symphony Hall and hear great music, right? We can hear all sorts of great music, even in a local concert. And that kind of brings us together. But if you think about it, the love of art and music, we love it for two different reasons. Christians love it because we say there is an individual created in the image of God, creating and using, in a sense, the creativity God has given to them, right? What does the atheist think? Well, this highly evolved animal somehow kind of figured out how to do something that kind of serves, it doesn't work very well, does it? And if there is no God, he says, and all reality is the result of accidental, purposeless evolution, then what is the experience of beauty? What's beauty all about? Is it merely an electrical, organic moment within our brains and nothing more? I was saying to somebody when I was working on this, I've really been tempted to put together some cards that say something like, the experience you just had at the Morton Meyerson is actually just an evolutionary adaptation so that you would go find a mate. And hand that out to everybody there and see if anybody would say, yeah, I really agree with that. I mean, you walk out of there and there's a transcendent quality to music, isn't there? There's a transcendent quality to going and seeing the great paintings of the world, whether you see them in this country or in another country. And to just simply chalk all of that up to materialism doesn't work very well. He says this, we've all heard the riddle, if a tree falls in the forest and no one is there to hear it, does it make a sound? He says, I've got another question. If a tree grows in a forest and no one is there to see it, is it beautiful? How would the Christian answer? Of course it is, because it is beautiful before the Lord. Even if we don't see it, the Lord sees it. But if you think about this, from a materialistic worldview, when matter is all that there is, there's no God, there's no right, there's no wrong, there's no heaven, there's no hell, there's no supernatural, it's difficult to explain the existence of beauty and this kind of transcultural aesthetic that we see around the world. They can and do enjoy beauty, atheists, our atheist friends do, but they really don't have much of an explanation for it. So I thought I'd quote from Helly Ordway. Helly Ordway is one of the professors at Houston Baptist. They brought together some of these great apologists, and Nancy Piercy is down there, Harold and Holly Ordway and others. But I love what she says. She says, beauty is fundamentally useless. It is its own end and its own reward, and it eludes attempts to explain in utilitarian terms. She says materialists often argue that responses to beauty are evolutionarily adaptive, helping to attract mates or improve empathy, and thus increasing the likelihood of passing on one's genes. She says, this is bunk. It is reductive to the extreme, and these explanations don't hold up to the actual experience of great art, great music, great literature, and natural beauty. Do you agree? And so again, this is why this book is written in such a persuasive way that if you have a friend that kind of loves art or music or culture or the humanities, they're going to go, you've got a point here. It moves me beyond that. You know, if you're an atheist, you can't live consistently with your worldview. Because you say that there are things that are right and wrong, good and beautiful, things which we should approve of and things which we should criticize. And yet if you believe there is no God, there's no standard, it's just your personal preference. It really is difficult. Let's take another one there, happiness. And again, on your handout there, you see some, and I've just, again, picked just a few. But here he says, happiness is a moral responsibility, therefore God exists. Think about that. The Declaration of Independence gives us the right to pursue what? Happiness. But it is a pretty elusive goal if you think about it. Then you ask the question, why is happiness such a fleeting experience? If we look at our pets, you know, they seem content. They seem happy as they wag their tails. We come home to our dogs or our cats, our dogs especially, they're wagging their tail, you know, and I don't know what dog contentment or cat content look like, but they look pretty content. And human beings roam the planet looking for happiness. It's almost like we were made for something more, right? And he makes that very powerful argument. C.S. Lewis put it this way, happiness is not just a chemical interaction in one's brain, but a heavenly reality grounded in the reality of God, a God who is what? Joy. Even the idea of happiness raises the question. Well, that's the first segment. The others won't go, I will go through a little bit quicker, but the second is we also recognize, in addition to beauty, there's this yearning for a better world. And so one of the things he says is, human trafficking is a vile evil that must be stopped. Therefore, God exists. Why does he say that? Well, I think this is one place where we can get total agreement. We have a really divided political realm, but I haven't found too many people going up saying, you know, I'm a leader for human trafficking. I don't care if you're an atheist or a believer. I don't care what your denominational background is. I don't know what your political background, whether it's Republican or Democrat, independent. Everybody's against human trafficking. Both agree that human trafficking is evil. Both have volunteered to fight it. But how can we say it is wrong? Anatole France wrote this, "Nature in her indifference makes no distinction between good and evil. If nature is all that there is, how can you even say something like human trafficking is wrong? If morals really are just temporary, cultural inventions as a result of evolution, then they may be binding only within the society in which they evolve." That's called cultural anthropology, right? And you can impose them on the individuals in the society that evolve those, but you cannot impose them on other societies, right? And for any of you that are Star Trek fans, remember the law that they are supposed to follow? They're not supposed to impose their morality on any other culture. Of course, it seems like Captain Kirk was doing it all the time. But nevertheless, you know, that's the case. But think about this. If indeed you believe that evolution is the reality, if you believe that morals just have evolved in a particular society, then the society might be able to hold those individuals accountable to that. But they cannot take those morals somewhere else. In other words, Westerners cannot go to Cambodia, they can't go to India, and rescue children from sexual slavery, because that would be what? Imposing your morality on someone else. Find me an evolutionist that has any kind of morality at all that buys that argument. Because again, they cannot live consistently with that idea. There seems like there is a moral standard. And if there's a moral standard, there must have been what? A moral lawgiver to have given that standard. So again, this is one of his arguments. Let's take it a different way. Cruelty to animals is detestable, therefore God exists. We all believe that we should treat animals wisely. Francis of Assisi said this, it's a great quote. "If you have men who will exclude any of God's creatures from the shelter of compassion and pity, you will have men who will deal likewise with their fellow men." So again, a person that treats their dogs or their cats or anything with disdain, they might also treat human beings that way. Well, Dennis Prager has been on the program with us before. He's a talk show host. A while back was interviewing the president of PETA. This is the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. You know who they are? Okay. And he said, let me ask you a question. Let's imagine I'm traveling down a very narrow alleyway in a car, and all of a sudden, a little girl and a dog come in front of me, and I have just enough room to miss one of them. Which one could I possibly hit? The president of PETA could not answer the question. "I cannot save both, but I can save one. Which would you choose to hit?" Because from her perspective, there is no moral difference between a dog and a little girl. Now, I would suggest to you again that even some of our evolutionary friends, even some of our atheistic friends, know there's something wrong with that, but they don't really have an answer for it, do they? Do we have an answer? Well, if there is no God, human beings are just members of the animal kingdom, and then we should be diligent in doing all of those. However, if God exists, then we're able to affirm cruelty to animals is wrong, and that human and animal life are not of equal value. Because human beings are what? Created in the image of God. So Christians have an answer for that. The atheists don't. And here's another good, just evangelistic question. Ask your atheist friend, why do you care so much about the ethical treatment of animals? If you don't believe that God has given you any instructions to do so, is it just out of compassion for just living creatures? What is your basis for that? It's a real good conversation starter. So it goes on to another one. Let's take the negative now. I'm embarrassed by the bad behavior of believers, therefore God exists. You ever run into that one? Usually that's the one used against us. Well, I'm not a Christian because they're hypocrites in the church. Well, I understand that. I've run into a few of them myself. You know, maybe I'm one of them, so I understand that. But Richard Deccalion said, organized Christianity has probably done more to retard the ideals that were its founders than any other agency in the world. Or I love this one. Catherine Whitehorn. Why do born-again people so often make you wish they'd never been born the first time? But again, think about this. If godless behavior believers bothers us, why is that the case? Another good question for your atheist friends. Why does it bother you in the first place? I mean, I know why it bothers me, because I know that not being consistent to the founder, Jesus Christ. But why does it bother you? Because in a godless universe, which you live in, people are free to set their own moral bars wherever they stand, you know? So, you know, why would that be a problem? I mean, if indeed you don't believe there's God, don't believe there's really any absolute moral standards, then everybody kind of does what they're right, why would you even have a problem with a person that calls themselves a Christian acting immorally? Why would you have that problem? It's a good question. Because in some respects, what they're trying to do is sneak in and take a biblical idea and use it to beat us over the head with it when they say they don't believe in the biblical idea, if you think about that. And so if nothing else, it says perhaps this reveals a moral standard within our psyches. All of us, I think, have that. Again, God has placed eternity in the hearts of individuals. From a very young age, you have kids saying, that's not right. That's not fair. You promised, right? They have a sense of there is a moral compass. Now, it's twisted because we live in a sinful world. We live in a fallen world and we're sinners. But nevertheless, that sense, that moral compass, I think, again, argues for the fact that there is something more to human beings than just their biology. And he says, we're bothered by a signpost pointing away from materialism towards theism. Then one other one, he says, protecting our environment is a moral issue, therefore God exists. John Muir said, God has cared for these trees, saved them from droughts, disease, avalanches, and thousands of tempests and floods, but he cannot save them from fools. Which I guess means if you don't agree with him, you're a fool. But nevertheless, if all living creatures are equally valid, how can one species take the life of another? And so again, this whole idea of the environment could be used as a conversation starter. And then he also talks about free speech. That's been in the news lately, hasn't it? I deeply value free speech and self-expression, therefore God exists. The famous quote from Voltaire, I disapprove of what you say, but I will defend to the death your right to say it. Not necessarily hearing that anymore, are we? Not in this latest environment. But again, from a naturalistic worldview, it would seem that the strong have the right to silence the weak. Isn't that called what? The survival of the fittest. So if you think about it, maybe this is one of the reasons why we're starting to lose this idea of free speech. The powerful, the strong, should be able to destroy the weak and the feeble. The power and strong should have the voice and the platform. The weak should not. And just think about this. Lenin took away the freedom of speech and the freedom of press. And of course, they're having a big debate in Washington. You know, right now we're having a debate about whether or not to tear down the Confederate monuments and memorials and statues. We're having a debate in the state of Washington in Seattle because they have a statue to Lenin actually in one of the suburbs of Seattle. And they're trying to think of whether or not they want to take that one down too, which I think just illustrates how interesting some of the debates are taking place right now on this whole issue of free speech. Well, let's take a few more real quickly. Shafts of glory. These would be a little more familiar territory. And that is, he says, I'm amazed at the existence of existence, therefore God exists. Martin Heidegger, the great philosopher, said, why does the universe exist? Why is there something rather than nothing? Well, Stephen Hawking thinks he has an answer, you know, this great scientist, astrophysicist. He says spontaneous creation is the reason there is something rather than nothing, why the universe exists, why we exist. It's not necessary to invoke God to light the blue touch paper and set the universe going. So he's trying to figure out a way that he can explain the universe without God. Now, he comes up with this idea of there being multi-universes, which we don't have any observational evidence for or anything like that. But I love what Descartes, René Descartes, you know, ex nihilism nihil fit, nothing comes from nothing. Or if you want something simpler, remember Julie Andrews in The Sound of Music? Nothing comes from nothing, nothing ever could, right? You know, same kind of idea. And does it make any more sense to claim that the laws of physics have always existed than it does to claim that God has always existed? I think, again, as he points out, the existence of the universe and the laws of the universe are awe-inspiring, but they don't really give an adequate cause for the existence of the universe. We would say that there is a cause and effect, and this great cause led to this great effect. The great cause is God, led to the great effect. We can look at it a different way. He talks about this idea of the glory of the universe. That, by the way, is from the Hubble telescope. Isn't that beautiful? And that is looking at the center of our Milky Way galaxy. Next time we have a Star Watch party, everybody come out. Doesn't look quite that nice, but it does look nice, and it will be fun to have. But again, he asks this question. I'm staggered by the glory of our universe, therefore God exists. Now, this one we covered last week a little bit when we got into this with the eclipse, because I quoted from Paul Davies' book, The Goldilocks Enigma, or the New Physics, this idea that the universe is fine-tuned. The universe is like the Goldilocks. The ratio of the proton to the electron is adjusted to one part in 10 to the 37 power. That's one with 37 zeros off the page. Or the electromagnetic force tuned to gravity adjusted to one part in 10 to the 40th power. So again, as I used the illustration last week, it's like we're in this room with all these dials for the universe, and every one of those dials is adjusted perfectly. A little bit to the left, a little bit to the right. You don't have a universe. And then we look at all the things having to do with our solar system and our Earth and our planet. Once again, the glory of the universe. Edward Harrison is an astrophysicist who said, here is the cosmological proof of the existence of God, the design argument of Paley. William Paley was an individual who was both a pastor but also a philosopher that used the watchmaker argument, and was an argument for the fact that design implies a designer. He says the design argument of Paley updated and refurbished. The fine-tuning of the universe provides prima facie evidence of deistic design. Isn't that something? Or one, George Greenstein, we've used this quote before, as we survey all the evidence, the thought insistently arises that some supernatural agency, or notice that, or rather agency with a capital A, must be involved. Is it possible we have stumbled upon scientific proof of the existence of what? A supernatural being. Well, what about mathematics? You know, those courses a lot of us tried to avoid. But again, interesting enough, he says, mathematics and numbers are no mere games, therefore God exists. Rick tells the story of being in a calculus class. Yes, some of us did have to take calculus, both differential and integral calculus. And at one point, one of the students said, what is the use of this? We're never going to use this. And the teacher said, well, mathematics is just one big game. That's all it is. I'm here to simply to teach you the rules of the game so that you can play it if you want to. But I think we can recognize that mathematics is not just a game. If anything, mathematics is one more way that we can see the order of the universe. And these two philosophers put it this way. For Augustine, numbers were already present in God's mind at the time of creation. Mathematics helps us understand the order that we see. And again, it's just one more argument for the existence of God. He goes on to say that truth is more real and important than preference. He talks about one student that came up to him and said, of course, what you probably have heard before, that may be true for you, but it's not true for me. But the trouble is that even if you believe in postmodernism, you have your view of truth and I have my view of truth, you have a different view of truth. He says postmodernists become modernists on the freeway, in the dentist chair, and at home, right? There comes a point in time where even if they say that there's different truth, you know, you go into the dentist chair and the dentist say, where's your pain? Well, whatever truth works for you. No, you're going to say, it's this tooth right here that's giving me the pain, right? You know, we just live in this world where you can't walk away from truth. There are such things, as Francis Schaeffer called, true truth, truths that endure, truths that are supercultural. Then he talks a little bit about this idea that the miracle that is me, which I thought was kind of interesting. I wonder about the wonder of the self, therefore God exists. Now again, if you have somebody that loves films, loves to go to movies, this would be a book that you might want to hand to them, because he talks about, and I want to give you three examples, of films and television programs who all have one thing in common. Spartacus, Elephant Man, Buffy the Slayer, Vampire, he had a whole list, I just simplified them. Those are diverse enough. What do those have in common? Not much. They do have one thing. Each character said, I'm not an animal. Have you ever seen the movie of the Elephant Man? There's a point in which the 18th century people see him and he shouts out, I'm not an animal. Whereas an evolutionist would say, yeah, I think you are an animal. See the point? You know, we recognize almost instantaneously there's something more to us than just our biology. John Steele put it this way, how can we square this self-conception of ourselves as mindful, meaning-creating, free, rational agents with a universe that consists of a mindless, meaningless, unfree, non-rational, brute physical particles? That's a good point. Because if indeed everything's here is randomness, then there should be no meaning to life at all. There should be no concept of right or wrong or self or future, and yet we treat each other as if we believe the biblical idea, even if we intellectually say that we don't believe that. He says, I also wonder about the wonder of doubts, therefore God exists. You know, Thoreau put it this way. He said, faith keeps many doubts in her pay. If I could not doubt, I should not believe. And think about this. Doubts are common to humans. And again, lots of times Christians say, well, should I have doubts? If you're a human being, of course you'll have doubts. He goes in, what are things that don't have doubts? Oh, I know. Robots don't have doubts. Computers don't have doubts. But we think, we question, we doubt. And just the fact that that illustrates again that we're not like a machine. He says, I wonder about the wonder of human dignity, therefore God exists. Peter Singer is an ethicist at Princeton University. He said that when the death of a disabled infant will lead to the birth of another infant with better prospects of a happy life, the total amount of happiness will be greater if the disabled infant is killed. Even this last week or so, there have been Breakpoint commentaries and other secular commentaries about the fact that Iceland is convinced that they will soon get rid of Down syndrome because they make sure that every woman is tested and they abort every child that might have Down syndrome. Well, we look at this and we're sort of horrified because we recognize what? God has created us in His image. And everybody has value and dignity. Even the Elephant Man we talked about just a minute ago. And even the loss of good health does not negate that fact. There's a great illustration of that. Maybe you have seen him before. Nick Vilcek. Here is a young man who's born without arms and without legs. From an evolutionary or atheist point of view, from Peter Singer's point of view, he has no right to live. And these are just a couple of his books. Life Without Limits, Unstoppable. There he's surfing. And some of you have had a chance to go and hear him speak. And again, we can, as Christians, affirm this. The question I ask from atheist friends is, if indeed we believe in an evolutionary process, you know, survival of the fittest, what kind of meaningful life could he live? We know the answer, don't we? Finally, feeling homesick at home. There's a desire in us as well for something more. C.S. Lewis said that, you know, if we feel hungry, it's because there is a way to meet that need, food. If we have desire for relationships, there's a way for me that to meet that, to have other relationships. But we have a desire for the supernatural. There's something that we can't seem to meet here on earth, right? And that would suggest that we were created for something more than earth. Well, here he goes into this in a couple of ways. First of all, looking at the negative. I long for a world without pain and suffering, therefore God exists. For many atheists, this is the biggest roadblock. You know, if you ask most atheists, and next week I'm going to cover another book that's kind of was written by a skeptic who himself was really having trouble being a Christian because of this issue of pain and suffering until he kind of thought through the issue, became a Christian, and now is a pastor in one of the largest churches in Canada for skeptical Christians and skeptical non-believers. But this is a big roadblock. We understand that. Nicholas Woldersdorf wrote this really long essay, but basically what he says at the end is, if you will, we all experience grief and sorrow, but yet as Christians we also recognize that while suffering destroys us, it also has the power to remake us. And I don't want to be cavalier about that, but sometimes people that have gone through great suffering oftentimes have seen the positive aspect that suffering has had in their life. Well, again, we can understand that because Jesus is what? The suffering servant. I put down Psalm 22 and Isaiah 53 and some others. I long for lasting love and community, therefore God exists. We seem to be hardwired for love, created for community, but yet sometimes it's difficult to do. Community is sometimes hard to maintain because of human sinfulness and the fall, and we believe that love is eternal. We just studied this, 1 Corinthians 13. Well, for the atheist, love is just a biochemical reaction. But for us, we know that love is what? Eternal. And so again, that points to God as well. I long for immortality and eternity, therefore God exists. And again, if there's no God, why do so many human beings throughout history, and even on the planet right now, believe in an afterlife? Because they believe there's something else besides the physical world. If there is no God, if life is just an accidental event, and if human life is no more valuable ultimately than animal life or insect life, is it even rational to grieve so deeply? We've had many funerals right here in this chapel. Some people are going through tremendous grief. They may say, well, I'm going to see them someday, but I miss them now. Why this incredible grief? Why does death hurt so much when we've known for a lifetime that it was coming? Well, I think the answer is that the Bible teaches that we're not mortal, but immortal beings, that we will live forever. And so grief is kind of a deep and sensible notion that death is not right. It should not be. We look forward to a day when there's a new heaven, there's no earth, and death is the final enemy to be destroyed, Paul says. It's not right that we be separated from our loved ones, and we look forward to an afterlife that is better than our life right now. So again, Rick Steadman, I think, is, you know, even in all the funerals he's done over the years, used this as a really powerful argument to point people to God. So I've, in a fairly short amount of time, covered quite a number of the chapters in the book. But again, this is a book, as I mentioned before, that is published by Harvest House, just come out. Rick Steadman is a pastor at Adventure Christian Church in Roseville, California. And so he's really had quite a ministry in that regard. But if nothing else, I hope that it would just encourage you a little bit, number one, to see that our belief in God's faithfulness, our belief in God's word is true. Our belief that the existence of God makes sense, but also see this as, again, one of our evangelistic moments. This may be one of those books you might want to hand because it's written in such an engaging way to your non-Christian friend. And if they're interested in art or music or philosophy or pop culture or movies, or as we talked about just a few minutes ago, even superheroes and horror movies, this might be a book that might get them thinking a little bit more about the fact that God does indeed exist. EJ?